This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government.
Dr. Jonathan Abel. I'm here with Dr. Bill Nance.
Hello.
And our guest today is Dr. Amanda Nagel, who's associate professor here at DMH. Welcome.
Thank you.
And we're going to talk about one of her specialties, which is race relations in the U.S. Army, kind of late 19th, early 20th century as our epicenter. So let's kind of start at the beginning of that time period. The Civil War is over. The country is in a time of transition, both with regard to the fallout from the Civil War, but also mass migration and changing cultural mores and all those things. So how do we get from Civil War, slavery, to kind of the 20th century within the U.S. Army with its race relations?
Well, it is a short but long story, I guess is kind of the way to put it. In terms of the way that the U.S. starts focusing on this, and the U.S. Army really kind of focuses on this in the aftermath of the Civil War, is that as units are being discharged, as demobilization is occurring for the Civil War, some of the units that are remaining in uniform and also starting to take part in the occupation of former Confederate states are from the USCT, the United States Colored Troops. So they are manned entirely by African Americans, at least at the enlisted.
These are segregated units.
Segregated units, okay. Yes. All officered by white men.
Okay, so it's all right. All black enlisted and all white officers.
Yes.
Now, does that include non-commissioned officers as well, or is there some mix there?
So there's a push to try to get some more non-commissioned officers. We're starting to see that. But the push then becomes after the Civil War to get African-American officers for mm-hmm. some of these regiments. Because in the aftermath of the war, as you know, with Reconstruction, there's military Reconstruction. And so it's a military occupation of former Confederate states. That is part of what creates some of this animosity in terms of racial relations as former Confederate states are being welcomed, quote unquote, welcomed back into the Union, forcibly so in some cases. And so the issues there are essentially come from armed black men who are now in positions of authority over white men. Mm. And that's a whole new experience for whites in southern states.
So how many soldiers are we talking about? Are we talking 25% of the Army, 50% of the Army, 10%? Oh, am I going the wrong number?
It's I don't know the exact percentages off the top of my head, but okay. It's definitely not 50%, right? Mm-hmm. But it's enough that particularly as rebuilding is occurring in the South, elite whites are a little leery about this whole why are black men having guns mm-hmm. thing, right? And that's actually particularly because prior to the Civil War, there are laws on the books in a lot of these states that specifically outlaw mm-hmm. The use of guns by African Americans unless, in some cases, it's their slave owner, they are enslaved, and they are being observed by their owner, right? So, it's those sorts of things.
Yeah, and there's this pervasive threat and fear of slave uprisings that are often brutally repressed by the whites, right? I'm not sure it has a name, but the one in Louisiana in the early part of the 19th century where, hundreds of slaves are crucified?
Yes. Yeah, that is part of this, and it's not just. And that's the thing is Carrie Lee Merritt's "Masterless Men" is a great book on this topic, because what she does is really discuss what this means for, in the antebellum era, for white men as well, right? White poor men,
yeah.
Because they are also feared by slave owners. They are feared by the elite because they outnumber them.
Right, classic class division.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, what kind of missions are these regiments doing now? Are they still classified as United States Colored Troops, or are they classified as United States Army regiments?
Yes. Yeah, so they're this is that transition moment, right, where we're starting to see them move from being regarded as USCT to US Regular Army. Right, and the number of those regiments are going to continue to shrink until we get just four, right? The 24th and 25th Infantry, and then the 9th and 10th Cavalry.
Okay, so, and what kind of missions are they doing in the in these states right now?
Essentially, they're just stability. It's stability ops, essentially, right? If it's policing in some regard, right? Because they're occupying forces, right? They are sometimes protecting polls when it comes to voting, right? Because that is another part of this too, is what do voting rights do? Once the 15th Amendment is passed, what does that actually look like in practice, right? So part of that has to do with those sorts of protections.
Mm-hmm.
But then soon enough, in the late 1860s, early 1870s, we start getting the creation of the Klan, right? It's almost immediately in the aftermath of the Civil War that we get the rise of the first version of the Ku Klux Klan, to then try to push back against all of this seeming instability.
Mm-hmm.
And that essentially it's in this fear of the unknown, this fear of what happens now that my group of people is not in power. How do they react? Well, they react violently, and that's part of this. So it focuses on who has guns, who has the right to self-defense, all these sorts of things when it comes to this newfound citizenship for freedmen and women.
So what's the reputation of these units like? And now I'm not talking about like necessarily under the occupied,
right.
but in the case of, are they seen as good units, bad units? Or is it just kind of generic?
So it's kind of, it depends, right? It depends on each unit, right? It really does. And so for some, a lot of this is, it's just that even during the Civil War, there's this attempt to sometimes keep some of these regiments out of combat because theoretically they didn't know if they could actually engage in combat and engage in combat effectively, right?
Mm-hmm.
Despite the fact that prior to the Civil War, there's this history of black military service in the United States, right? All the way back to the American Revolution, before the American Revolution, we see this. And so for some of these regiments, it's just more that they are going to be doing, say, behind the scenes stuff. It's going to be like support area. Right, what we would now call like the support area, or like I'm losing my train of thought. It's kind of
what we used to call the consolidation area.
Right,
now it's
yeah,
the rear area.
Right, yeah, like that sort of stuff. It's just it's the behind the front lines sort of thing. Right, it's the menial labor. It's digging trenches. It's building stuff. It's so that's it. That ends up then transitioning into what some of them end up doing in the aftermath of the Civil War, right? Just because part of what is happening in the aftermath of the Civil War is rebuilding infrastructure. How do you do that? Who do you get to do that? And so that's part of what happens. But as we move into the 1860s, 1870s, that starts to change, because when that military occupation is no longer happening, now what do you do with these troops? Well, they start going west, right? Because that this is also at the same time that we are seeing wars with indigenous populations in the West.
Now, this is not just the African American soldiers
right.
at this point.
This
is the whole army.
The whole army, right? And the whole army had actually been doing this during the entire Civil War, anyway, right? Not all U.S. regiments ended up in the Civil War. Many of them were out west, and so that then becomes more of the concentration. And so that's how actually how the that's how we get the nickname Buffalo Soldiers, is because of their interactions with and fighting with Native populations.
So this is a very interesting part of this whole story. We tend to think of the American West in large part because of spaghetti Westerns mm-hmm. as being very white.
Right.
But in reality, the American West was probably the most diverse part of the country at the time, because you had lots of First Nations people, lots of Hispanic people, mm-hmm. lots of Black people, lots of East Asians. We mm-hmm. tend to forget there were lots of East Asians, as well as, you know, mm-hmm. A lot of white people. So when as you said, we start transitioning out of Reconstruction mm-hmm. or 1870s into the West, what happens to these units and these soldiers as they go to this space that may be more actively hostile fighting First Nations, but also maybe less socially hostile?
Mm-hmm. So in these cases, so part of what we are seeing is there is going to be an attempt by African-American communities and white allies of those communities to get Black officers for these units.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually how we get the push to try to integrate USMA in the 1870s.
Flipper is the...
He's one of, right? He's
yeah.
one of.
He's not the, he's the first graduate.
He's the first graduate. He's not the first cadet.
Yes.
Right? That was James Webster Smith, right? And so his time at USMA is actually very indicative of what ends up being how Flipper then tries to react differently to belong... in a way to essentially try to mitigate some of the stuff that happened to Smith in terms of how his fellow cadets treated him, right? And then so Flipper tries to go the completely different route than Smith did. And Smith was a bit more assertive in terms of, all right, racism, I'm essentially experiencing prejudice here. These are some problems. Flipper goes the complete opposite and doesn't say any of that. He doesn't really speak at any point about his time at West Point being anything but, yeah, it was all right, it was fine. When very clearly, most likely, many of the same things that happened to Smith happened to Flipper too. But he saw he kind of viewed this more as a go along to get along, to then be able to get through the program, right? Soon after him, within a decade, is Charles Young. So we are going to see at least some movement on that side, but it's very little and limited, specifically because of how few commissioning locations existed at that point in time. Mm-hmm. And so for
people who aren't familiar, this is long before ROTC.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, if you were going anywhere in the Army, you kind of had to go to West Point.
Yeah, it was either that or direct commissioning,
yeah.
right? Those were the two options.
Right, and in a peacetime, you know, there's only yeah. so many slots.
And
right.
they're not, and the Army's not big anyways.
Yeah.
Right.
So we have this mission of securing the West, mm-hmm. we'll use that euphemism.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got these Black soldiers. Are they still in segregated units?
Yes.
Okay.
For the most part, yeah.
So
it's mostly white officers, but...
So nothing's changed there.
Yeah, nothing's changed there.
Has their experience changed being out, you know, away from southern cities and towns, being out on the plains and forts and dealing with First Nations?
Yes and no. Right? Racism travels west just like everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to encounter some of these white settlers who are headed west as well. And so, racism follows them. One of the issues with that, too, is how they socialize with the people around them. Because there are, against some of the myths, right, most of the myths about the West is that not just it's spaghetti Westerns, not just that it's mostly white, but it's men.
Yeah.
Right? It's supposedly a very male environment.
It's just John Wayne, right?
Right. It's just John Wayne.
I'm cool with that.
he's gonna call people pilgrim and whatever.
Yes.
Right? But the reality is that a lot of people are out west. The West is, like you said, it's very diverse, and it's not just diverse in terms of race, it's also diverse in terms of gender. And so that is where some of this tension will come, is how do people interact, and particularly a large group of men, who is now in a new location, how do they interact with each other?
This is the old racialist fear, right?
Of, oh, yes.
Of the black male around, I'm assuming, largely white women.
Yes.
Well, and then you add in the fact of what happens anytime a large group of young soldiers show up
right.
into a local community.
Right.
Chaos.
Well, yes.
Well, so let me ask real quick kind of the basic dumb question for retired Lieutenant Colonel Nance. You have commanded troops. You have commanded troops on stability duty in Iraq, so in a foreign culture. So this is a really easy question to answer, but I think it's worth walking through. What does pervasive cultural bias like racism do to a unit in that situation?
Well, the soldiers are going to will react the way they are treated, if that makes sense. So, for instance, if they're met with hostility, there's going to be an increasing level of antipathy? Yeah. Antipathy that the soldiers will then reciprocate. You'd like to think that everyone's going to turn the other cheek. No. There's going to be fights and all that kind of stuff. Not so much in stability operations, but where it's actually more interesting is if you look at soldiers in garrison areas. Like you go to like Killeen, Texas, or El Paso, Texas.
Which are very much the West at this time.
Right. I'm just talking in the 2000s.
Maybe still the West.
Yes. Or in Manhattan. It's like anytime you have a large group of young soldiers in a community, that is going to create some frictions there because you have a large group of young 20-something or 18, 19-year-old males, and they're going, and what are they going to do? They're going to
blow things
drink,
up.
They're going to fight, and they're going to find women as to the best of their ability.
Mm-hmm.
And that is going to cause tension with the local community who doesn't necessarily like to see this. So in the modern era, we try very hard to be partners with our local communities. And part of what it is because we started to see these tensions that would outright result in soldiers ending up in fights. My grandfather would tell me stories about how at Fort Bliss, whenever they went on weekend liberty, they would keep a platoon that was held back over the weekend, and on Sunday evening, they would all get in full battle kit, march across the bridge into Juarez, and break all the soldiers out of prison.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's one of those cases of setting race aside for the moment. The fact of the matter is, anytime you add a large number of soldiers into a civilian community, there's going to be friction and tension.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, well, and that then becomes, when you add race into it, it becomes, okay, how do you prevent incidents from happening, right? How do you do that? Like, that is actually, quite frankly, the challenge for white officers who are assigned to African-American regiments. The other thing, though, too, is one of the long-standing traditions for the Army prior to integration was taking white Southerners and placing them in positions of authority within African-American regiments, within these segregated regiments. Because the perception was that because they're from the South, they've been around enough African-Americans most of their life, and that they're more accustomed to being able to understand and deal with African-Americans. Now, as we know, that is not usually going to go well.
Yeah.
In some cases, because of how the racial interactions, you're going to have white officers who...
You're inducing a discipline issue.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like, you're going to create more tensions that way, simply just because of the way that their bias is already viewing their own soldiers.
So...
And then it cascades from there, right?
So we have this odd situation where, as you mentioned, sometimes we are literally exporting the racial and class structure of the East to the West. And yet the West is a place that is sold as the place of agency. It's the place you go to make your life and your future. Is that true for these black soldiers? Do they have opportunities in the West that they wouldn't necessarily have back East?
They do in some respects, for at least certain amounts of time. It essentially, until more people, and particularly more white people, move West, that shifts for them. That's mm-hmm. that point. It's the same thing with Native populations in what used to be Mexico, mm-hmm. and then Gadsden Purchase, right? Until, like, that area was at least more peaceful, so to speak, mm-hmm. right? And Hispanic Americans were able to maintain control over their own lands until about the 1880s, when it started to fill in with more white settlers. That's when the contentions over land, over who owned the land, what those land grants looked like that came from Spain,
right.
you know, decades and decades before, what that meant for being able to stay on essentially their ancestral territory.
Right.
Right? And that's the thing, is that as some of this as time passes, that's going to be where some of it shifts. Now, I mean, even with the myth of the cowboy, right? More cowboys were African American or Hispanic American than they were white right away.
Right, but a lot of vaqueros.
Exactly. And so there's a long tradition, essentially, of knowing how to do these sorts of things, and specifically dealing with horses and all of that within these communities, that we as a public tend to forget that exists.
Right.
No. Right. And that connection doesn't necessarily be made. Yeah.
Now, let's talk about the military structure that's out there, because this is soldiers are not on large division corps level bases. Most of the times they're out. A cavalry troop's probably too small.
A cavalry
squadron, which right. for our purposes today is about, which equivalents about 300 to 500 soldiers, mm-hmm. which is a pretty small outpost. So mm-hmm. with that said, a cavalry troop might if it's at full complement, mm-hmm. which it probably isn't, mm-hmm. they've got three officers, and then any number of non-commissioned mm-hmm. officers filling that out. So in a squadron, you might have a squadron outpost, you might have 15, 20 officers, mm-hmm. maybe, and the rest are non-commissioned officers or soldiers or mm-hmm. troopers if you're right. using cavalry.
Right.
So does that actually give the African-American soldiers kind of the opportunity to kind of gain a little bit more agency, get a little bit more of a chance to kind of show their own, or?
It depends, right? It depends on where they are. It depends on who they're around. It depends on, in some cases, who up the chain of command is going to allow some of that. Now, because of the fact that there are so few soldiers out West, because of the fact that after the Civil War, the U.S. Army shrinks significantly, there's a necessity that they're going to end up in combat. There's no way around it, right? And so they do get a bit more, they do get more chances than they would in another time frame, right? Just simply because the Army needs them. The Army needs them to do stuff. Therefore, they're going to do stuff.
Necessity trumps racism.
Pretty much.
Yeah. So, kind of following on that, the West is a place where myths are born, too. It's not just a place where you go to find yourself. This is a time, and this is odd for people to think of, because a lot of times people think Jim Crow appears right after the Civil War, but this is not Jim Crow yet. Mm-hmm. So this is a country that is at least more receptive to black agency than it has been. Mm. So how important is it to culture, to American culture, that you have, as you point out, these mm-hmm. Buffalo soldiers out West who are living the cowboy life, who live that myth?
I would say it's more important for African American communities, not so much American culture broad strokes, right? So remember, even though the Northern States, the U.S. fought to, you know, eventually the strategic goal became emancipation of slaves, There's still a lot of racism in across the nation, right? We tend to have this myth of it's only in the South. It's only in the South.
Right.
No, it was everywhere. It permeated the entire country. So even though there are going to be some who laud integrating West Point, there are going to be others along the same vein who they'll take their pot shots at the former Confederacy, but they will also agree with them on the capabilities of African Americans and in terms of how they are viewing what they can and cannot do.
And this is the standard racist trope of these people are not skilled or smart enough to be real soldiers, so they need to dig ditches, that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. So right. And so but with that, what ends up happening is that it becomes, and like I said, it's more important for African American communities that this is the case. It's not so much for America writ large, and that's simply because in the aftermath of the Civil War, we are also seeing the rise of minstrelsy, and so you've got shows across the nation that tour that essentially the using blackface, focusing on stereotypes. You got with this, I mean, you mentioned earlier this idea of black women or black men and white women, right? That then becomes the overly sexualized black man, which is also then somehow you also still have the overly sexualized black woman in the Jezebel, right?
And yeah. So it's the fear of miscegenation,
right? So these stereotypes are really at play in terms of when we're talking writ large American culture, but for African American communities, people like Bass Reeves are very important to them. That's where that importance comes from.
Bass Reeves, real quick.
He was a sheriff, a U.S. Marshal, I believe, out west, African American, one of the few. I think worked for the Texas Rangers at one point in time. I don't remember exactly the. There's a show about him right now. I believe that the Lawman, I think, is what it's called. Yeah.
Now this is a fairly esoteric question, so we'll see how far we get with it.
Yeah.
But you're talking about in the community. So now, as for instance, recruiting. So the U.S. Army has gone through any number of different iterations of that work. So how are these four regiments, let's just talk about the 24th and 25th and 9th and 10th, how are these units recruiting, and is that any different from how the rest of the U.S. Army is?
I don't know if it's different necessarily, but what you do find, and this is for African American regiments from this time frame all the way through the early 1900s, it's easier to keep them in the unit.
So retention is
good. Oh, retention is great because there's far less desertion. There are far fewer discipline problems that you were talking about earlier in terms of the garrison life, right?
Which
far fewer
is not always the fault of the soldiers.
No, it's not always the fault of the soldier. No, it's not.
But I will agree with that.
Right, right. But that's the thing is that for African Americans, there's this now this newfound freedom. What does this mean? What does this mean to choose to do certain things? What does it mean to choose to serve in the military? What does it mean to take part? Now, one of the things for African Americans is that this is the promise of a steady paycheck, right? This is one of the issues in the late 19th century after emancipation is that immediately in the aftermath, it's finding jobs, right? And especially if many of them stayed in the former Confederacy. Well, a lot of them end up as sharecroppers because they get into these contracts and they're tied to the land through their former slaveholders because they need someone to work the land. Well, this is a population that doesn't have jobs. Well,
and education, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And well, if I remember correctly, this system was largely set up by the Freedmen's Bureau to help the former enslaved people, but it ended up becoming a tool of repression.
Yes, yes. And that's the thing. So military service is not just a way for employment, but it's more so, there is a sense of pride there. There is a sense of almost an ability to display masculinity in a way that is sometimes and had been sometimes infrequently denied to African American men, that they could learn these sorts of skills, this trade, so to speak, that you could get with the army. And additionally, it meant travel. It meant getting out of the South. It meant getting away from the end of Reconstruction, right, in 1877. So these sorts of things are part of that. But then there's also the myth making that you were talking about earlier, and particularly the myth of, right, the mythology kind of surrounding the Buffalo Soldiers within African-American communities, right? That's who I want to be. And that's who I want to be like.
You're sitting a couple hundred yards from a Buffalo Soldier monument.
We are, because we had some of those regiments come through here at a variety of times, including after World War One. They were here for, I think it was the 10th, if I remember correctly, it was the 10th Cavalry who was here after World War I in the 1930s. Well, and so there's that connection with the African-American communities in Kansas City.
And there's a cavalry troop. There's a troop up at West Point. There's the famous Buffalo Soldier Field where they would train the cadets on equestrian.
Yes. So and that's a lot of what they did here, too, so along with plenty of other things that were not associated with their jobs.
There's an irony coming. So late 19th century, we are moving towards, if not true social integration, at least a self-aware agency having black community. We're kind of sticking arms and fingers through the door of equality.
Right.
And then come the 1890s, that door is slammed shut on many of those arms and fingers.
Yes.
So can you talk a little bit about big picture, what's changing as we move into what we did call the Jim Crow era?
Right. So after Reconstruction, we start seeing, it's varied. Each state is different when it comes to how this looks after 1877, after the Compromise of 1877, right? So prior to that, so even as early as 1866, we're starting to see what are referred to as the Black Codes. And so these are laws that are actually mirroring the slave codes and even some of the laws targeting poor whites, and specifically poor white men prior to the Civil War. Now, the Black Codes are essentially attempts at control. Control in a variety of ways. Control economically, bodily, and autonomy, and autonomy control, like all those sorts of things. And so it comes down to, like, we start seeing excess vagrancy laws. We see laws on who can vote, who cannot vote, right? We start getting things like the poll taxes, the grandfather clause, all this sort. Like, these are all, like, at least tested during Reconstruction with the Black Codes. Now, in some places, that's going to be rolled back with Radical Reconstruction. In some places, it's going to just at least permeate and continue. After Reconstruction ends, we start seeing it varied across different states, where some are going to start pushing these measures faster and more intensely than others. And so by the time we get to the 1890s, we already have an extent of that in a lot of states. So in 1890, that's when we start getting what will become the Plessy v. Ferguson case out of Louisiana. That doesn't get to the Supreme Court until 6 years later, right? But Homer Plessy sues in 1890 because of segregation in public transit.
Right, and this is important because it's a government institution. Louisiana, yes. Is it the streetcar, the train?
Trains, I believe.
Yeah, so it's a public institution. Mm-hmm. This is not, you know, it's not a private school.
Right.
It's a public institution that has a racial segregation rule. And of course, the Supreme Court rules, that's fine. That's what, you can do that.
Oh, yeah. The Taney Court was like, oh, yeah, it's all good.
Right.
Right. But after that, like, this is the moment when we start seeing that shifting a bit in terms of how then the army is even going to approach this. Because if Jim Crow is essentially the law of the land now, courtesy of Plessy v. Ferguson, the army has to then follow it, right? And so how do you fight wars while you're also segregating your soldiers?
And, oh, by the way, we are immediately fighting a war with the Spanish-American War.
Within 2 years, yes. And that is one of those things. It's just how do you transport that? Like, how do you do all these sorts of things? So what we also see in this time frame is that by the 1890s, we've already had I think three African American officers once Charles Young is commissioned. There's a small number of African American officers total for all of the units in, that exist, right? We start seeing a few more just simply because one of the requirements is that, right, chaplains, they have to be officers, right? So that is one of the avenues that African Americans go through to become an officer in the Army, is that they're going to be a chaplain, right? So that becomes an avenue, but it still is so few within these regiments that there's not a whole lot. And so what so with that, now, in the 1890s, you have, one, two generations removed from the Civil War? These are now people who have been born free. All they've known is freedom. So that's going to shift how they're also thinking about military service because of what Jim Crow does in terms of limiting citizenship. And so they see military service as an avenue toward that freedom. Now, that's part of a long tradition too, right? In that, in the Civil War, Frederick Douglass, one of his speeches in 1863, I believe, was talking about this idea of extended citizenship to those who serve in the military, specifically because you have to show that you're going to be part of not just part of this country, but that you are willing to sacrifice. And because of that, they cannot deny that you are going to be a citizen.
Yeah, rather than being passively liberated, you are taking part in your own liberation.
Yes, and that was part of what he was talking about too, is that now you can rise up and then take part in this. You can help liberate your people. But then from there, what does that mean for citizenship? So, I mean, even these are things that are being discussed well before the 1890s. But now, specifically with the Spanish-American War, at this point in time, you've got a generation that is joining the Army that has never known enslavement. And so their view on what their citizenship is, what it means, and how to access it is completely different than previous generations in terms of how they're looking at this, right? And so there's going to be this view among those soldiers that this is how we do it. We military service, this is the way, because with this uniform on, I am showing that my duty to my country, because this is my country, right? That's also the assertion. This is my country. This is not just your country. I am from here too. I am a citizen. That then allows them to assert that masculinity that in many cases they are being denied through some of these laws that exist, as well as social mores and attempts to control populations in the South, right? There's this assertion of I am a man, and this is one of those things that make me a man. Military service.
Yeah.
And so with that, then it then becomes, here's how we fight for equal rights.
Which we'll see later in the Double V campaign in World War II.
Yes.
I want to dwell on this Spanish-American War aspect, because it's one of America's forgotten wars. We forget. We fought what we would now term a multi-domain operations war in the 1890s. So what role do these black units and do black soldiers play in this war that's being fought in the Philippines, in Cuba, across the oceans?
Save TR's butt.
Well, yeah, I mean, actually. Yeah. Actually, that is a big part of what they do, is they save TR's butt. And then he,
yeah, we'll get there.
He decides to, yeah, but anyway, before that, so one of the things that we see is that with the Spanish-American War, it is viewed as a way to potentially reunite the country. It's about reconciliation, right? So that's why we have former Confederate Joseph Wheeler as one of the officers for one of these African-American regiments during the Spanish-American War.
Ordering them to attack Union positions on a few occasions.
Famously quoted as, come on, boys, we got the Yankees on the run.
Right.
Right.
In 1898.
Right. Right. Yes, that Joseph Wheeler.
Yeah.
So he's one of many who are now have been welcomed back into the United States Army after having taken up arms against it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it is viewed as a war of reconciliation, and in some ways, it's the thought is, if when we call for volunteers, hopefully they'll come from everywhere. And they do. They actually do. There's a lot of volunteers who come from all over the country, and so that includes volunteer regiments from various African American communities across the U.S. And that joins with the 9th and the 10th and 24th and 25th, the regular Army regiments that are already set to go. And so all four of those regiments will see service in Cuba specifically. I believe some of the volunteer regiments also did. I can't remember exactly which ones, but there are a number of volunteer regiments, black and white, that just sit in Florida hanging out.
Most famously is the First United States Volunteer Cavalry with the Rough Riders.
Right.
Which is what we're getting at, which is the other two regiments in that were the 9th and 10th Cavalry.
Yes. And that's Kettle Hill, not San Juan Hill.
Yes.
But hey, so many myths.
Right.
So many myths.
So the myth
all
is
surrounding Teddy Roosevelt.
The myth in Cuba is that Teddy Roosevelt commands the Rough Riders.
Mm-hmm.
And
a bunch of Yanks from Ivy League universities.
Right, which he is also a Yankee from Ivy League University.
Yes.
So he takes San Juan Hill and basically defeats the Cubans.
Mm-hmm.
What's the reality of that story?
The reality is very different. This is a hard fight for Kettle Hill. It really is. The Rough Riders were actually supposed to come in as relief for some of the units, including the 9th and 10th Cavalry, that had been doing a lot of this fighting. So as the Rough Riders were coming in, these other regiments were asked to retreat, essentially because they're trading positions, right? Like, this is a normal
It's a relief in place.
Yes!
Yeah.
That's exactly what was happening. But, of course, TR didn't seem to know that was what was happening, because it's TR. He's gonna TR. And so he was actually yelling at them to keep going and go back into the fight, and they were like, we're being ordered to go the other way. What are you doing? They basically kind of looked at TR like, well,
like most an amateur.
Most people looked at TR, right? Like he was a little loony.
Yep.
Right. But that's the thing. So what then comes out of that is that the narrative becomes, oh, they're weak, they're cowardly.
Right.
That's why they were retreating. That then becomes the narrative that he starts spinning after he becomes president. Right, but one of the things that is actually quite interesting and becomes very important to African American communities, and particularly because of the impact of the black press in the United States, because they start writing about this stuff. One of the things that that is particularly interesting about the Spanish American War is that Spanish soldiers did not want to fight African American regiments. They didn't. They would see them coming and they would not want to actually engage in combat because of the reported ferocity and essentially like being good at combat.
Sometimes myth-making right. works in your favor.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Which we'll see later with the Harlem Hellfighters.
Exactly, right? Yeah. Myth-making works in your favor in this case, right? And so the Spanish in Cuba were like, oh no, we don't want to fight them. We'll fight these other guys, but we don't want to fight them because they know it's going to be a tough fight, and they know they're probably going to get their asses handed to them.
Well, also if you take a look at it, these are four regular Army regiments.
Yes.
Now the 9th and 10th Cavalry are fighting on foot because we can't figure out how to get horses from Florida to Cuba. But
we try, boats sink. It's not great.
It happens.
Horses drown. It's not good. They get sick. It's bad.
But what we end up with is that these are four regular Army, well-trained,
mm-hmm. yes.
for the era, well-trained regiments.
Yes.
And if you have a yes. host of volunteer units,
yes.
you're going. There's a marked difference between a volunteer regiment that
yes.
shows up and guys that have been kind of doing this for a minute. And if you say that they have high retention, that means that these guys have been doing this for a hot minute.
Yes. No, and that's the thing, is that you have, in these regiments, you have a lot of NCOs who have served for probably 20 plus years in those regiments. Maybe like moving from
one job to the next.
Right, right. Like moving from battalion to battalion, like you, like company to company, whatever. They are still there. And they have been there. They are career soldiers, and so they have gotten experience, plenty of experience out west, in their time in the last essentially 20 years prior to the Spanish-American War. They are very good at what they do, but they also know what their service and what their actions in combat mean to their communities, and so that is part of what drives them too. Right, so it's the combination of the two, really.
So what we have is an interesting inversion of the racist trope, where in this war we have a lot of very professional, very skilled black units fighting alongside amateur white units, like Teddy Roosevelt's Rough Riders, which is kind of interesting, as you say. If we move out of the war, which the U.S. wins easily.
In 18 weeks.
Yeah. We're entering the era of progressivism, and as you mentioned, there's also a black press. There is a self-conscious group of black Americans who are working for the betterment of their community, and they have a press that is able to expose some of the arcanities of structural bias, which is not something that we saw maybe in prior periods to the same degree. So you would expect, perhaps, that we would continue down the road of growth of agency, rights, privileges. How does the Progressive Era treat black soldiers in particular?
It's complicated, right? So the black press helps a lot because they are essentially creating heroes, right? And one of the things that is really useful, at least in my research, is the fact that so many soldiers who were literate wrote to these newspapers.
Interesting.
And those newspapers then, of course, published those letters. So the fact that now we have archive, like that gives me some archival evidence here for some of what I study, and that then becomes one of those ways in which you can kind of see this focus on how are we as black men bettering our communities through our military service. Well, one of the things that you start seeing in the late 19th, early 20th century. Is this idea of race men and race women, right? So these are leaders of the race. They are exemplars. They are going to be people who others will emulate, right? There are certain characteristics that define who is a race man, who is a race woman, etc., right? It's going to be that they are educated. It's going to be that they are that sometimes university graduates. They're going to be professionals, but they're also going to be people who will be fighting the good fight. Right, this fighting for more rights, expanded rights, fighting for their people in these ways. So it's just, I mean, they're leaders, essentially leaders in their community. What eventually will be referred to as the talented 10th, right? Mm-hmm. So.
And this is the double life theory, right? The idea that you live your own private life, but you also live the life of the representative of your subaltern group.
Yes. Yes. And so in this case, race men are going to be ones who will lead the way. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that actually one of the soldiers who wrote into a local newspaper in Illinois was writing about was basically begging for race men to join the army. Because he and many of his peers wanted to see people who looked like him. Mm-hmm. Officer their regiments.
So basically bring in the educated upper class of black America to join the lower class in the ranks.
Yes, because one of the requirements, of course, for being an officer in the United States Army has and always has been a college education.
But
that's the thing, is it's basically like there's multiple letters from I think it's the 24th Infantry. I can't remember which company, which, but I can't remember which company, which battalion. But this soldier constantly wrote in, like, send us your race men. Please send us the educated. Send us those pillars, because they can then be our leaders here as well. And then guess what? When they come back to society, they're going to also be race men in our communities, right? They're going to have that position. And so there's very much this kind of emphasis on how and why you can get, and essentially on getting more African-American officers. Not so much enlisted, not so much NCOs, officers.
Right.
And what that might look like.
Because the enlisted soul side is kind of already figured out as a
whole. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's the officer side that you need to kind of, we know how to do it, but it's getting there.
Right. It's not just getting enough people to do it, but it's also, in some ways, forcing the Army to let them in.
Yeah. And it's worth pointing out, too, the Army has more than just race problems during this period.
Oh, yes.
It's got a massive class problem.
Oh, yes.
And that's an ongoing issue that will not be solved until World War II.
Right.
I think it's fair to say. Right. So, again, we are painting a picture of a lot of hope, a lot mm-hmm. of progress. We're moving into the first truly progressive presidency, mm-hmm. Teddy Roosevelt's.
Mm-hmm.
An accidental presidency, but a presidency nonetheless. So how does the progressive Teddy Roosevelt administration deal with these issues?
Well, not well. Now, moving into this time frame, moving into the progressive era, one of the issues that we still see, and we will continue to see for African-American soldiers, is lynching.
Mm-hmm.
Racial violence targeting them. And again, not just African-American soldiers, not just veterans. This is writ large across the United States that lynching violence is, it's mm-hmm. targeting particular populations. Frequently, that ends up being people of color,
mm-hmm.
right? African-American veterans are some of those targets. Mm-hmm. And that actually includes in the Leavenworth area.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, mm-hmm. an African-American veteran was lynched in this town in the late 1890s, early 1900s.
Yeah, and I think you make a very important point that listeners need to understand on two levels. One, lynching does not mean simply the murder of someone who is black. It can mean violence directed towards someone of a racial minority, usually black, but not always.
Right.
It can be used in more general ways. To refer, for example, to mass boycotts of black mm-hmm. businesses, although it does tend to always have some sense of violence to it.
Yes.
And, as you pointed out earlier, lynching is not confined to the old Confederacy.
Right.
It is pervasive throughout the country. And, for example, one of the most violent and virulent Ku Klux Klan chapters is in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
So people understand this is not an old South problem. This is a national problem.
Oh yeah, no, this is absolutely a national problem. And you add in that lynchings are public spectacles.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that people are tacitly in support of, because mm-hmm. this is essentially vigilante violence. This is taking due process out of the loop of anything.
Right.
And so that's what some of these soldiers are facing. They're dealing, and veterans are facing. They're dealing with knowing that going back home sometimes might mean violence against them specifically to be used as an example to keep others in quote unquote in place.
Yeah, deterrent, yeah.
Right.
So how does Roosevelt and his administration, how do they handle this?
So Roosevelt does not handle it well. He is also, he is the president who will invite Booker T. Washington to the White House. He will have audiences with different activists, including Mary Church Terrell, right? These are prominent African Americans who are politically speaking, they don't necessarily always agree. There are multiple strains on how to go about racial uplift. But regardless, Teddy Roosevelt is actually like inviting them in, and he does have audiences with some of them,
mm-hmm.
right? The issue becomes more so with how he as a person tends to react to things, and automatically just kind of, at least in this case, as soon as he finds some information out, even if it's not the full story, he will act, and then he will not actually retract what he's done, right? So in this instance, I believe what you're referring to here is the Brownsville affair.
Mm-hmm.
So 1906, Brownsville, Texas.
A shining pearl of Texas culture.
Sure, yes, that's exactly what it is. If you are unfamiliar with where that is located, it is pretty darn close to the border.
Yeah, it's essentially about as far south as you can get.
Yes. Fort Brown is right there. So it's one of the areas that is also not exactly friendly to people of color.
Great irony, because right. Of course the population is disproportionately people of color
right.
in that part of the country.
Right. So, and that's we don't have time to get into the long and difficult conversation of what do race relations look like in Texas because of how
right.
many different populations live there and how do they interact with each other. That's a story for another day.
Right.
But in this case, what we see in the summer of 1906 is a battalion of 24th Infantry. No, 25th. Sorry. I'm flipping
an infantry battalion.
No. I'm flipping in my head. This one in the Houston uprising is all it is, right? So prior to coming to Brownsville, this battalion had been actually in Nebraska. I'm not going to try to pronounce the name of the fort that they were at because I can see it in my head. I can't remember exactly how to spell it, and therefore I'm not going to slaughter it right now. They had just spent, I believe, like 2 or 3 years there, and actually had some decent relations with the local population. Like, they didn't have many issues, but it also has to do with the fact that they were very well disciplined. Like, very well disciplined. There were no issues that you would normally see with garrison soldiers. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that occurred prior to their transfer was a request, and this comes from not just the colonel overseeing the regiment as a whole, but all the way down into the battalion itself. The 5 or 6 officers from the battalion, including the chaplain, Captain Theophilus G. Stewart. Yeah, it's great name.
Yeah, that's a great name.
I believe that's who that was. Like, I might have to look it up to verify, but I'm pretty sure that's who that was. All of them wrote letters to pass up the chain of command to essentially to get to the War Department to say, hey, can we stop stationing black regiments in the South? This is what happens when we station them there. And so a couple of them had only been with the regiment for a little while, so they didn't really have a long list of incidents. But a few, and this includes Stewart, were like, all right, here's this. Like, essentially a laundry list of what happened the last time.
Mm-hmm.
This regiment was stationed somewhere in the South. This is the reaction that they had. This was the interaction that they had with the local populace, with the other soldiers at the garrison, all this sort of stuff, right? And part of the scant evidence from some of these newer white officers was actually coming from Fort Riley. So they had done, the regiment had done a field exercises with a Texas National Guard regiment. And Dr. Abel is laughing, which means he knows exactly about what I'm, he knows exactly what this is, what it is that I'm about to say. It was, it did not go well.
Yeah.
I think to put it mildly.
Yeah.
Every time a member of the Texas National Guard Regiment passed a member of the 25th, there were racial epithets, insults, you name it. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, and the thing that each one of these white officers put in their letters to discuss these particular incidents was specifically that our soldiers held it in. Our soldiers did not react. They did not lash out. But they should, and then the book, but the point for them was they should not have to experience this.
So, retired Colonel Nance, you're commanding this training. You have these two regiments, one mistreating the other not reacting. In theory, what should happen?
In theory, what should happen is that the commander of the offending unit is called in and told, this either stops or bad things happen. And bad things can mean any number of things. Mm-hmm. What in the modern U.S. Army, what would end up happening is, at the minimum, is you're going to see a substantial number of leaders relieved. And depending on where you can kind of draw the line as to, okay, who is not just perhaps condoning is bad enough, but who is instigating this, who is allowing this to happen. And if you can go up to the level, you're going to basically tear a lot of that out.
Okay. So that doesn't happen, of course. Our black regiment gets sent to Texas anyway. Mm-hmm.
And then. So one of the things that, and it's actually some of the stuff that I'm talking about right now actually comes out in the Senate hearing after the fact, which is quite frankly a treasure trove of information that is just absolutely amazing. And thank goodness for digitizing stuff like this, because I love having digital copies of these sorts of things.
Yeah,
very very helpful for research.
Yep.
So as they're transferred to Fort Brown, they are relieving a white unit. Okay. One of the things that is noted in the Senate hearing was that there was talk amongst the local populace prior to, and this included lawmen, basically saying that they were going to try to figure out a way to deal with the African-American regiment coming in. Now, that's right. These are not necessarily the words that they used.
I don't think we can say the
words
they used.
No, we are definitely not saying the words that they used. But they were going to try to find a way to deal with them, to take care of them, to get them out.
Mm-hmm.
Find a way to make sure that they would leave quickly, because they didn't want them there.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually included a Hispanic American officer,
mm-hmm,
in the local sheriff's department, right? Like,
mm-hmm,
there's levels, there's yep, there's layers here.
Yep.
Border
race relations.
Oh yes, border race relations. So, what? One of the townspeople noted, or actually it was one of the med officers that had to stay behind for the hospital garrison,
mm-hmm,
the garrison hospital, he noted, as the 25th came in, not a single soldier was in chains, was essentially under arrest,
mm-hmm,
and headed to the barracks. Not a single one. Which he thought was like, wait a minute. You don't have anybody under arrest right now? That's not normal,
mm-hmm,
right? That was not normal. That was not the way that he had witnessed any unit, mm-hmm, coming in or out, right? Mostly white,
mm-hmm,
right? But this was, and the reason I make this point is because one of the things that we start seeing in the late 19th early 20th century is making sure, and particularly for African-American regiments, making sure they are more disciplined and better behaved than anybody else.
Right. This is the model minority problem, right?
Oh, yeah.
That the visible representative, yes, of the subaltern group must be better than average.
And in their case, they had to be better than average because violence would ensue.
Right.
what would happen then, right? Like, it's essentially, it was, in some ways, it's self-preservation, mm-hmm. but also it's, we've got to be representatives of the race, therefore we can't do these things. But more than anything, it was about avoiding violence.
So this may be the best disciplined regiment in the U.S. Army.
One of, yes.
Coming into the to
yeah.
the post.
Yeah. Okay.
So they get there, they set up.
Right. They're there for a couple of weeks. And so one of the things that actually occurs during their time there in the first, 12, 13 days, like, right, it's literally like 2 weeks, between a couple of weeks between when they arrive and when this all goes down. One of the things that happens is payday. Mm-hmm. Now, this town was ready for what is normally payday.
Yeah, and our former officer is smiling a little bit. Yes. He knows what happens when soldiers get money.
Yes, he has already kind of discussed a little bit of it.
Yeah, they're going to go out. They will spend their money.
They're immediately going to spend it all.
Right. Well, so one of the things about Brownsville is that it was also many of the town's shops, even the local saloon, refused to serve these soldiers. Mm-hmm. Right. In any respect. And that's actually where some of the tensions started to build up. But what ends up happening is because they're only going to be allowed to be served out of the back of one of the saloons. They're like one of the soldiers. He was actually getting out. Like, he was on his way. Like, he was in the process of being discharged, and he was like, "Well, all right, screw it. Let's create my own bar." Like, so he actually, no, I'm serious.
In the finest tradition of American soldiers in the West.
Absolutely.
Not just in the West, capitalism.
Right, he and another local Brownsvillian basically pooled their money and, like, got a sponsorship from the local saloon owner, mm-hmm. because that's how they could get essentially what we now refer to as a liquor license.
Mm-hmm. Well, right? the other thing, too, is that the saloon owner's got a problem, right? Because... Yeah. I'm not going to serve soldiers. Okay.
Right.
I'm a bar owner next to an army base. How am I making my money?
Right. No, I mean, he's going to make his money, but but that's the thing, is he was willing to serve them only out the back door,
yes.
not in the saloon itself. Right. That's a huge difference. So
racism light.
Racism light. Yeah. So in this case, these two decide, okay, we're just going to make our own, because if they won't let us in their space, fine, we'll create a space for us, right? So payday comes, and it is the calmest payday that Brownsville has ever seen. Mm-hmm. There are no fights in the streets. There are no drunken brawls, right? Specifically drunken brawls. There are no arrests. There's nothing. It is calm. It is the quiet, and the mayor made a point to say this in his testimony, and said it was the quietest payday they had ever seen. Within 3 days, there's a supposed march on the city, march on the town from the garrison, mm-hmm. shots fired. No one dies, one person dies, and a horse dies. And it's unclear as to who shot any of the guns, but it ends up being... Supposedly, it was the 25th that came out. They marched out from the garrison. They marched through the town. They shot it up. One person died. One horse died. Like, that was mm-hmm. there was a big deal made about this. Mm-hmm. that these were the casualties, and then they went right back into the post. Mm-hmm. It's on one of the it's all very sketchy. So it's on one of the darkest nights that they had. Like, mm-hmm. you could barely see much of anything. They didn't have really street lights, mm-hmm. right? The moonlight wasn't much that evening. Mm-hmm. You couldn't really see very far at all. But somehow, some way, some of the townspeople could swear that they could identify African American soldiers marching through the town.
Right.
Right.
To do something that is dubious at best.
Right.
So how's Roosevelt treat this?
Well, pretty quickly, as the investigation starts, it's unclear as to who's doing what. There is what becomes referred to as a conspiracy of silence for the unit. Right. The unit actually also gets immediately transferred out. because there's talk in the town of going into the garrison and grabbing them and...
Essentially lynching them.
Lynching, yes, yes. We're talking about vigilante justice here, right? The town is insistent that they also charge the soldiers, that it's not just through the army courts. It's an absolute mess. But the whole thing is, it all starts with, and because of, supposedly, an attack on a white woman by one of the soldiers in the garrison. Mm-hmm. That's what then leads to the gunfire.
Right.
Which then leads to... Right.
Which sounds suspiciously like the story of Emmett Till and hundreds of other lynchings.
Yes. Exactly. Now, in this case, right, if you're taking into consideration, right, this is one of probably, if not the best disciplined unit in the army at this point in time, mm-hmm. that they had the calmest payday ever, right, that they had no one under arrest on their way into town, why would any of them be stupid enough to attack a woman, a white woman, by the way, mm-hmm. who is at a boarding house right off the garrison? Mm-hmm. Why, right? Why would any of them be that dumb?
Right.
Right? So that attack then leads to a lot of tension between the townspeople and the garrison. Eventually that night, shots go off throughout town. It's unclear who marched through. By the next morning, it is still unclear as to who did what, right? Now, soldiers testified in the Senate that they recognized or they recognized or did not recognize certain gunfire, right? So this is actually right at the moment. This is right around when this unit moved from the Crag Jorgensen to the Springfield. Mm-hmm. The Springfield was brand new for them. So they knew the sound of a Crag. They knew the sound of a Springfield, right? And at least one testified, that was not the gunfire I heard. It was not a Springfield. Mm-hmm. It was something else. We all had Springfields. Mm-hmm. They were firing something else. That was the type of gunfire I heard. Now, because of this, and this includes the unit that was there before them, the Brownsville was kind of obsessed with the Springfield and the Crag Jorgensen because they're new, they're different, they're not really something anything that they've got. So one of the things that ends up becoming part of garrison life for soldiers there, and particularly the unit that was there before the 25th, was to trade with locals spent shells, and then they'd get obviously something in return. But like that was a thing. That was a trade that was going on between soldiers of the garrison and townspeople. Mm-hmm. Well, one of the officers found a few spent rounds right outside the garrison wall from Springfield's, and so didn't check. He didn't do a sniff test. Mm-hmm. To see if it was fresh, right? You could actually smell the gunpowder.
Oh, yeah.
He didn't do that. He just noted that they were there and they were at the outside of the wall. So he took them into the major in charge of the battalion, and that was like, all right, well, I think then maybe our soldiers did it. Okay. Well, there's constant pressure for retribution. As they moved to a new location, because they couldn't for safety reasons stay there, this is where we get to this idea of the conspiracy of silence, mm-hmm. right? Not a single one of them would come forward with information on anyone who took part in this, because they all said they didn't know. They didn't know who did it. They didn't know who took part. So it became then a problem. And so for Teddy Roosevelt, it was, well, they're all, just drum them all out because they won't talk, they won't say who, they don't do all these things, get them out. Get them out. Would not flip on that. Mm-hmm. Would not reverse, even after some more information came out. And so because this was as murky as it was, a senator from Ohio decided to start investigating. And that is actually how we get the Senate subcommittee hearing on this, to get some of this testimony. And actually, like, learned that it's probably not who you think it was. It was probably actually the townspeople. Mm-hmm. In a way, to try to at least a few of the townspeople, just to try to get rid of these soldiers. But it leaves a lasting impact, not just on the soldiers themselves, who, many of whom were very close to 20 to 25 years of service. Mm-hmm. By being discharged without honor, they lost their entire pensions that they've been working for the past couple of decades. Right, so they started petitioning to try to get back in. There's, so there were Teddy Roosevelt, like, bent on a few of those, but left the majority as a mass discharge without honor, right? And as you know, that follows you around.
Oh yeah.
That, like,
and that, you're also probably a 50-year-old man without any job prospects.
Right, you have no job prospects, or well, and if you had job prospects, they're also now gone.
Right.
Because it's a discharge without honor.
Yeah.
Right? And so there's... it's very frustrating for any other unit that ends up coming into that roughly that location and that area in the aftermath of this, because there's a long memory in Texas about this. And so anytime another African-American unit shows up in some of these bases in Texas, it's going to be another Brownsville.
Right.
Right? Because even though through the Senate hearing, it's clear it probably wasn't these soldiers, or if it was, it was a very small minority of them. It is not the entire battalion, right? It is not all of them, but it becomes then part of the long memory of how they interact with black soldiers. And so, I mean, you get this, you see this with the First World War, not just with Houston, but actually with other, with other regiments in that area, and stationed in Texas, is that they're like, well, their commanding officers basically say, like, oh, I understand you're trying to challenge Jim Crow. I don't care. Because we don't need another Brownsville. They actually tell their soldiers
this. It becomes axiomatic.
Yes. And so so when it comes to TR, he will kind of hold his ground even after Mary Church Terrell comes on behalf of these soldiers to try to ask him for some leniency. And this is like November November of 1906, which is actually within I think she goes to see him, if I remember correctly, like within like a week or two, like it's within the time frame of very quickly he then signs the order for their discharge for this mass discharge of soldiers. It's crazy.
It's fascinating that the U.S. Army managed to survive all of these issues and to become an institution that functioned in the world wars, because of course these will continue through those conflicts.
I mean, it was functioning.
Yeah.
How well?
Yeah,
that's a long story. Yeah.
Well, that's why we're here. This has been a fascinating conversation, Dr. Nagel. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty, so you can get to know them.